Okay, so tonight, rather than giving a whole Dharma talk, I thought to offer a few maybe somewhat loose reflections, and then anybody who wants to, we can have a discussion session towards the end. And as always, if you would rather maintain silence, you're welcome to leave at that point and do your own practice. So last night I offered a way of looking at the interrelationship between these four Brahma-Vihara qualities of kindness or metta, compassion, karuna, appreciative joy or mudita, and equanimity, upekkha. And I suggested that they could be arranged around a diamond shape with metta at the bottom as a foundation for them all. And when metta, goodwill, turns towards dukkha, it becomes compassion. When it turns towards what's going well, it becomes mudita, appreciative joy. So these two are the side points of the diamond. And when we can open fully to both these aspects of life, what the Taoists call the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows, then we experience equanimity. So equanimity sits at the top point of the diamond. It's the pinnacle of these practices. And equanimity is the heart mind that's completely at ease with what is. There's no wanting. There's no not wanting. It's the quality of deep acceptance, stillness, peace. And those of you who are familiar with the Buddha's teachings and all of his different sets of numbered lists, you will know that equanimity also appears as one of the seven factors of awakening. These are seven skillful mental qualities that, when they're perfectly in balance, they provide the optimum condition for deep insights to arise. Hence their title, Awakening Factors or Enlightenment Factors. And I haven't referred to this list too much yet, partly because I'm wary of introducing list overload. I know that can be a byproduct of the way these teachings are presented sometimes. But just for context, the seven are mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, samadhi or concentration, and equanimity. So this list of awakening factors appears in the Satipatthana Sutta as a set of skillful qualities that can be cultivated when the five hindrances have been released. So it's worth noticing that there are only five hindrances and seven awakening factors. So we've got the good guys outnumber the bad guys. And all of the various meditation practices within the Satipatthana Sutta are really designed to help these seven awakening factors arise and stabilize. That's where all of this practice that we've been doing on this retreat is aiming. And you might have noticed that equanimity appears at the end of the list. It's the last of the seven factors. And I don't think this is any accident, because for most of us, equanimity is a quality that takes some time to develop. It takes time to condition the mind into the peace of equanimity instead of our more habitual reactivity of various kinds. So I'm going to be speaking a little more about equanimity and not the other six yet, partly because equanimity appears as both a Brahma-Vihara and an awakening factor. So it has a role in strengthening both of these two wings to awakening that we've been exploring, the wisdom and the compassion wing. So I think of equanimity in some ways as being like a hinge, or perhaps even the body that these two wings grow out of. And there is it plays a very powerful role in developing wisdom. So there's a clear relationship between equanimity and insight. And it's a two-way relationship. Because we need a steady, stable, quiet, non-reactive mind in order to be able to see clearly. And when we can see clearly, the insights that arise still the mind into even deeper peace. So the other night I briefly mentioned that the insights that we're cultivating here are not only what we might think of as psychological insights, personal insights into, for example, our histories or our emotional patterns or our default personality settings. Those psychological insights are valuable and they can also start to reveal more impersonal or universal insights. Insights into what are known in the Buddha's teachings as the three universal characteristics of all experience. The fact that everything is impermanent, anicca. Because it's impermanent, it's unreliable and unsatisfactory, dukkha. And there is no stable, fixed entity in here to whom all this is happening. That's not self or anatta. And just to point out that generally speaking, this is not how we usually see ourselves in the world. Most of the time we resist the truth of impermanence, anicca. We try to make our experiences and our relationships stable and dependable and unchanging. And then following on from this misperception, we don't want to fully acknowledge that there's nothing in this world that can offer us a reliable source of lasting happiness. In other words, we resist the truth of unsatisfactoriness, of dukkha. And in a similar way, we want to believe that there is a me at the center of this universe to whom all this is happening and who is in control of it all. And we have this unconscious belief that if we just keep trying hard enough for long enough, eventually, surely, we will find that elusive happy ever after. So we resist the truth of not self, anatta. And because seeing these three characteristics more clearly does challenge some of our deepest conditioning about who we think we are and how we think the world is, we need strong equanimity of mind to be able to open to them. The opposite is also true. As we get clearer and clearer glimmers of the truth of these three, our habitual clinging and craving, grasping, resisting, identifying with experience, all of that naturally starts to let go. We stop resisting change. We stop searching for satisfaction where it can't be found. We stop referring everything back to a small sense of self at the center of the universe. And then equanimity, balance, peace of mind arises as a natural response to this clear seeing. So equanimity supports our capacity to open to anicca and dukkha and anatta, and it's also the fruit of experiencing these three characteristics more directly. So coming back to the first of these three, impermanence. For most people, this one, impermanence, is the easiest to grasp, at least intellectually. It's obvious on one level that everything changes. I'm no longer 5 years old, for example, although occasionally I still feel like I might be. Generally speaking, my life now is very different than it was back then. And it'll be different again when I'm 75, if I live that long. And of course, we can look around us and see that the seasons change and the weather changes, the sun rises and sets, There are natural cycles of birth and death in nature all around us that we ourselves are also subject to. But when it comes to the impermanence of our own bodies, most of us resist that change to varying degrees. And we can see this on a societal level, where there are whole industries that are devoted to denying the truth of the body's aging. Why do we resist the truth of our aging so much? Because it's not only that our bodies are aging, they're also going to die. And for most of us, that fact can bring up a sort of primal fear, existential terror even. One that we have all kinds of strategies to avoid feeling. And no matter how much we deny it, that fear is often driving us in very unconscious ways. And living in this fear and denial is itself a huge source of suffering. But as I mentioned last night, in relation to compassion and this capacity to turn towards what's difficult and to face it, when we are able to turn towards suffering of this magnitude, the truth of our own mortality, when we can meet even that with kindness, with care, with compassion, eventually even that suffering releases. And for most of us, this coming to terms with our own mortality needs to be a very gradual process. It's counterproductive to try to force it. And when I was doing the hospice work in the US, I did it for about a year. And what was striking to me was that going in every week, week after week, and all of that time, I can remember two or perhaps three people who actually mentioned the fact that they were dying. Mostly I had conversations about the weather and people's relatives and what was on TV and what they'd had for dinner and so on. And some of the patients on their charts had actually said, do not mention death, patient does not accept diagnosis. And this is a place where people went when they were within 6 weeks of actually dying. So it's counterproductive, and part of the training of hospice is really to keep respecting the patient's defenses. Likewise, we want to find a balance in relation to our own defenses of respecting them but not reinforcing them, and when we have the opportunity to explore, to investigate, not to postpone, because we don't know when we're going to die. A few years ago, a friend of mine in the US did die of cancer. And when she was in the last stage of her life, I asked her, was there anything that she wished she'd known earlier or done differently, or any kind of advice that she might have for me, who at that stage wasn't actively dying? And she was quite weak, but she thought about it for a while, and then she just said, keep letting go. Just keep letting go. Keep letting go on deeper and deeper levels. And that stayed with me, because in many ways that is what the Satipatthana Sutta teachings are all about. And we can see that particularly just within the first foundation, first establishment, mindfulness of the body. So we started by paying attention to the sensations in the body, to the breath, to the postures, fairly simple, straightforward things. And then a few days ago, I introduced the first of three sets of more directly insight-oriented practices, which is the first two are mindfulness of the anatomical parts and mindfulness of the four elemental qualities. So we did that practice of experiencing the body as its component parts, and then simplified into skin, flesh, bones. So really knowing the organic nature of this body. And then we also practiced with the four elemental qualities. So directly experiencing the body as an interplay of earth, water, fire, wind or air. There's a third set of body contemplations known as the cemetery contemplations or the corpse in decay. And this set of practice is not taught very much in the West, at least not in the retreat centers that I've spent much time in. And it's an invitation to contemplate our bodies as if they were a dead body slowly decaying. And this teaching comes after we've got used to thinking of the body in terms of its anatomy and in terms of its elemental qualities. So we've already got used to, on some level, not taking the body quite so strongly as me, as mine, as who I am, as under my control. And in India, in the days of the Buddha, death wasn't as taboo as it is in our culture. So it was quite possible to see, to go to a charnel ground and to sit with a decaying body and to watch it go through all these different stages of decomposition. Now, in this particular contemplation, we don't have to literally sit with a decaying body. The instruction is to contemplate as if, in quotation marks, as if we were a corpse. So the purpose of this practice is not, you know, when we hear it superficially from a Western vantage point, we might think, well, how morbid, how depressing, how sort of masochistic, because we do have this deeply conditioned reflex to recoil from anything to do with mortality. But when we can engage with this practice in the spirit that it's intended, it can bring a lot of relief, actually. A lot of relief of that desperate need to be in control and to try and make things a certain way and to keep chasing after happiness, really in all the wrong places. So when we were doing this contemplation of the body's mortality with Bhikkhu and Alio recently in Australia, I was surprised just how freeing it felt. And I have been working with these practices for quite a few years now, so and I've still got a long way to go. Nevertheless, in moments of touching into that really clear knowing of the body's own impermanence, I could understand more clearly that it leads to fearlessness. So one of the ways that Nibbana is referred to is as the deathless. And that was always a term that had been slightly puzzling to me. But on this retreat, I understood the deathless as having transcended the fear of death. And in some ways, that's what all of these practices are pointing to. Some of you are familiar with John Kabat-Zinn's quotation, "The one who dies before they die does not die when they die." So there's this understanding that the more fully we can prepare for our death now, the more alive that allows us to be. The more clarity we can have about what is truly important. What are our deepest aspirations? What do we really want to do with our lives? Are there any regrets that we might be able to take care of now while we still have a chance? So I don't know if there's too much more I want to say. I just like to highlight this connection in a way between this, the capacity that death offers us to really sharpen courage and to move into more fearlessness. Because when the grip of fear is released from our hearts and minds, there's literally more room for these Brahma-Vihara qualities to strengthen, to grow, and to fill. So there's a poem by the Australian poet and cartoonist Michael Lunig that, to me, is in this terrain. It says, "There are only two feelings, love and fear. There are only two languages, love and fear. There are only two activities, love and fear. There are only two motives, two procedures, two frameworks, two results, love and fear. Love and fear." So as we move slowly, gradually, gently into this contemplation of our own mortality, it can give us more of a choice about whether we choose love or fear. So I'll leave it at that for now, because I know this is a sensitive topic, and I wanted to take some time just to explore with anybody who would like to explore it, who has any questions. And those of you who would rather maintain your own silent practice, you're very welcome to continue practicing outside. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.